I really learned about essentially how people sometimes get caught up in a craze and then how things go up, bubbles get created, and then bubbles get popped. And we saw that in 97. That was one very valuable lesson because that's when then the Asian financial crisis happened. We went from extreme highs. Everybody thought, hey, I could become a millionaire in a day. It's no different than crypto. And I think if you have that perspective, back then I heard like this time's different and it's never different. We went from everybody was trading and everybody got caught up in margin financing. That's another own take on debt. You see what happened then. You saw the pattern just repeat itself. Once crypto's over, it normalizes. So there'll be something else. I guarantee you that. From that, what I learned was every generation has to relearn the lessons of the past generation.
Welcome to Brave. Learn from Southeast Asia's best tech leaders. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. No BS on success. I'm Jeremy Au, venture capitalist, Sierra founder, Harvard MBA, science fiction nerd, and dad of two daughters. Every week, we debate startup news, interview changemakers, answer listener questions, and share personal insights. Join our movement of over 40,000 members and get transcripts, resources, and community at www.bravesea.com. Stay well and stay brave. Are you a business owner, CFO, or engineering lead who's tired of grappling with outdated finance processes? Are you frustrated at the high costs of card payments or find yourself bogged down by manual financial tasks? It's time for a change. Meet Acme Technology. Our software enables you to connect directly with your bank of choice to automate all of your finance and payments processes. Enjoy real-time reconciliation and direct-to-bank payments and payouts. No lengthy integration. Transform your banking experience into a Stripe-like experience, all with easy integration through streamlined APIs. Learn more at www.tryacme.com. Hey, Thomas, really excited to have you on the show. Heard so much good things about you through the Harvard Alumni Network, and so really wanted to hear a little bit about your story. But please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, thanks, Jeremy. It's great to be here. My name is Tom Tao. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York. Grew up on Long Island, did the reverse immigration, and now I've spent more than half my life outside of the U.S. in Asia. I'm also one of the co-founders of Gobi Partners. We're a venture firm, Asia-focused, and I think we've actually worked with Monk's Hill on a couple of deals.
Yeah.
So delighted to be here with all your listeners.
So I've got to ask, like, all the way back, what were you like as a student, as an undergraduate? Were you partier? Were you academic?
Jeremy, boy, you're bringing back memories from my awkward days. I'm sure we all can go back and think back. But I think, like many of your listeners, I was a first-generation immigrant. My parents came from China. My grandparents fought on the wrong side. They were KMT. And so the family went to Taiwan. And then every family then, Jeremy, I'm sure it's familiar to many of the overseas Chinese families. One kid from every family was picked to go to the U.S. as an insurance policy. And so my dad and my mom were picked from their families. They met up in Brooklyn and they had me. So I was made in the USA. And again, if you think back then to the larger kind of global trends, what was going on was my dad got to the U.S. because of the Cold War. The U.S. needed engineers. And my dad was deaf, but very good at engineering. And so he was a beneficiary of that. But, you know, later on, I realized the discrimination he faced. And I think my father's generation, there were many of them of that generation. I think just like your parents, Jeremy, right? A lot of them went to Southeast Asia. Some went to Europe, but the overseas Chinese diaspora was quite broad. Our side went to the U.S. And great opportunity. Certainly, when I look back, I think back fondly to my teachers, my classmates. Very generous America was at that time. I benefited from the public school system. But we also always knew as well that we had to work maybe a bit harder because we were a minority there. We had to do more. And when I look back now, I just think of the generosity of my neighbors, but also the opportunities that were offered. But again, Jeremy, it was a lot less competitive back then. And so as a college student, I was fortunate. I was on scholarship, but I was also work study. And I benefited tremendously from the very generous financial aid package that Harvard had, and also from the U.S. government. But I was work study, so I had to work pretty hard. I always knew that I was brought there to maybe remind the legacy students of the opportunity. And it's really weird. One of my friends recently told me, Tom, we work our asses off so that we can raise daughters who look down upon the students that we once were. And I was like, whoa, that's kind of right. And It's really weird. I mean, when I look back now, we were given tremendous opportunity, but I also think that we were brought in to remind, and I think, Jeremy, I mean, we're working hard so our kids have that advantage, but we were brought in to remind those kids with the privileges what a wonderful opportunity Harvard was. Or you see what I'm saying? I felt like I was brought in and I had such a great attitude. And I was reading recently, like I did work study. I did dorm crew. I was cleaning up. I worked in the cafeteria. And now when I'm reading about from Harvard, they're saying that's, when you look at it from an equity standpoint, it's really not fair. Because there are students now saying, how can I be treated fairly if I'm the guy that has to clean up the puke from another student? How can I be viewed as fairly? And I was thinking, wow, I didn't even think about that back then. Right. So your question is, I think I had fun. But when I look at the sons and daughters of my friends, I certainly am not having as much fun as they are now. And even my own daughter, I think. But, you know, things are different.
Yeah. I think I really resonate with that. My grandparents left China in that multiple waves of emigration during that time period because of all the instability that was there, right? And they all left because they wanted a better life for themselves and they wanted a better life for their children and families. So I think there's that generational aspect for sure. How do you think that has translated? Because you said that's been something that is on your mind and you went off to start off your first job. How did you go about picking your first job?
Well, I think what I learned, and I think back then, Jeremy, at all these great schools, every class, when you're around senior year, you wonder to yourself, am I going to be a sellout, right? Because you have all these ideals when you're younger. And to a certain extent, we still do. But then reality hits in. And I remember the discussions we used to have over the dining tables. And I was a Winthrop House guy. We would discuss, oh, are you going to become a lawyer, a doctor? And I chose the banking path. And again, I was quite, I think, clear. I knew I needed to make money. I needed to pay off my student loans. And I heard some of my other friends, and they just had, I think, maybe less financial pressure. So they had more choices. And I kind of admired that. But, you know, life being what it is, I mean, I didn't feel bad because, hey, you come out with a Harvard degree and the Harvard degrees just opened up so many doors. And I feel bad for saying that because I feel like it only increases the competition. Look, there are other ways. There's other great schools. I mean, I look at now the admissions rate. I remember when I got in, it was the lowest admission rate ever. I graduated more than 30 years ago. The admission rate has gone down every year. So I say that, but for me, it was like, hey, I knew I needed to get out, at least get some financial independence. And that was very, again, I was very lucky. I was part of the SCO program, Sponsors for Educational Opportunity. I otherwise never would have gotten onto Wall Street. And that program really opened up the doors. And in fact, we can talk about this later, but then I brought SCO, the program, to China. But I feel like I've been lucky that there were always organizations that kind of helped open doors. And I've been a beneficiary and I've always been very grateful for that. And so, yeah, so I took the Wall Street path. So I went to a firm that many of the listeners may not even remember. It was called Merrill Lynch, which is now part of Bank of America. So I went to Wall Street after graduation.
What did you learn on Wall Street?
Wow. You know, I learned the work ethic. If you think about now, yeah, I learned about discounted cash flow, pro forma analysis. But when I think what I really learned is, wow, that work ethic. When you talk about 60-hour work weeks, you really start understanding what a 90-hour work week, what a 100-hour work week, and what a 120-hour work week looks like. And now that I think back, if we were doing that today, it'd probably be viewed as kind of abusive. But we did it back then, right, Jeremy? Nobody had hand phones. It was a different time. But I think what I learned on Wall Street, and I was very fortunate, worked with tremendously talented, again, people very generous with their time, with their networks. But what I also saw was, if you want to get ahead, my goodness, the work that people were willing to put in was really quite incredible.
Any particular mentors or lessons that you learned from that time?
Oh, I think so many. From the guys, I still remember a guy called Dan Kane, Merrill Lynch. I was in the FIG group. A guy that I worked with called Dave Casares. In fact, he just texted me on LinkedIn. But what we learned there was attention to detail. And Jeremy, you'll probably appreciate this. Well, I don't know if you will. You're a lot younger than me. One of the things we used to do as analysts was we had to go to the Bloomberg terminal and write down the stock prices and enter them into a Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet.
Oh boy.
And if you could graph that, wow, you were like super analyst. But again, the attention to detail, one of the things I remember was always check for typos on the footnotes. And that was drilled to me like, Tom, take it back. This is unacceptable. And what is the presentation's perfect. That typo is wrong. A footnote is wrong. The only product we make as an investment bank are the PowerPoint. And would a baker bring out a cupcake that had a speck of dust on it? And I was like, no. It's like, we cannot generate a PowerPoint that has a typo on it. And I was like, wow. And that was ingrained to me at a very early point in my career and something I've carried over. A lot of people that I've worked with, and I'm sure many of my younger colleagues are like, oh, Tom, you're so anal. But that's one of the lessons I took away because as a venture firm, right, Jeremy, we're in financial services or there's other, it's like consulting. The product we make are the presentations. So that's something that I always took away. The other lesson I learned was sometimes you don't get laid off. It's because you understand technology a little better than the older guys. And I'll give you, you probably remember this. Look, at the time, I survived a couple on Wall Street. There was always layoffs, right? I survived a couple of rounds because I was a master of a new technology then. I was one of the few guys who can convert the Lotus 1-2-3 files to Excel. And that's what really kept me my job is because none of the older guys could do it. And now when I look at what the younger folks are doing with TikTok, I'm like, well, they're mastering a new technology.
Yeah, definitely. And what's interesting is after this, you started to move from the US to Asia, but also during that time, also move into more of an executive role as well. So I'd love to hear you share about what was going through that transition from your perspective.
Oh, Jeremy, I'm sure you remember back then it was like, hey, if you did well, you do 2 years, right? It was really like boot camp. You get the third year analyst. And here's what I talked to a lot of friends, and you probably remember this, Jeremy. It's just back then, Hong Kong was the most exciting place to be on the planet.
So hot.
Right? This, and you know, I was coming out in 94. And I tell folks now, I'm like, there was a place that was more exciting than Silicon Valley, New York, Abu Dhabi, Doha. And they were like, oh, what place was that? I'm like, it was Hong Kong. Hong Kong, right before the handover, it was like the possibilities were endless. And so reading that, and I remember reading a novel called Taipan. I'm sure your listeners know that. And I was really reading that and I was like, wow, what an exciting place. And then of course the flat 15% income tax was also very attractive. And the fact that they'd cover your housing. You know, back then it was hardship pay, expat packages. It was a no-brainer. And I was fortunate. I made friends at the time with Merrill Lynch, some of the senior guys. And this was when Merrill Lynch was right about to set up and go into the China market. And so another lesson that I learned is don't always try to just talk to the cool people at a conference. Sometimes talk to the people who may seem a little by themselves in a corner, because that's what I did during analyst training.
Yeah.
I was sitting there and I saw a guy. I'm like, this guy looks like he's Chinese. He's standing there. Wow, he's older than everybody. That guy turned out to be Zhang Liping, who wanted to start off at the bottom, wanted to train with the analyst, but he had actually been tapped by the chairman, Bill Schreier, to run Merrill Lynch's China operation. So I just went to him and I said, hey, and this is, I got to give a lot of credit to my mother. My first language was Mandarin because my dad was deaf, really couldn't speak English that well. And I was like, hey, it's a Tongxiang Ma, where are you from? And he was like, oh, you're from Shanghai. And I'm like, yeah, well, what Baba is a Shanghai. And he's like, oh, you speak Chinese. And I'm like, yeah, we just got to talking. And then through that program, met another guy. His name was called Feng Feng, also was at Merrill Lynch. And it turned out these guys were the ones that were going to build out Merrill Lynch's China operations. And they say, hey, listen, one day, if you're interested in coming back to Hong Kong, you should look us up. And so I remembered that. 2 years later, reached out to them. We kept in touch and they're like, you absolutely should come out. And so for my third year, I went to Hong Kong. And again, I was a witness to China's rise. And we did one of the first IPO dual listings. It was for a company called Shanghai Petrochemical. And again, that team, I was very junior on that. I claim no credit. But that team then also did China's first global bond offer. So to really see that, and I think people sometimes forget, is just how far China has come, right, over these last decades. They went from having, they had no Moody's rating, Jeremy, to now being one of the largest issuers of sovereign debt. Sometimes we forget the perspective.
And what's interesting is that you said that you've always been a little bit more interested in technology compared to your peers. And so when you moved to Hong Kong, you didn't just obviously move to doing banking, but also started moving more into technology sphere as well. Could you share a little bit more about what you were seeing, what you're feeling, the context of that time?
Yeah. So again, in Hong Kong, I got caught up. If you remember right before the handover, Hong Kong was, Jeremy, how old were you in 97?
I was around. I would actually go to Hong Kong pretty often because my father's side is Cantonese.
No, there you go.
And then my mother's side is more on the Fujian side. Okay. So, you know, we'll go to Hong Kong very often actually.
But once, but in 97 as well. So you must have been still young though, right?
Yeah, I was still young. You take the Star Ferry. You know,
there you go. Yeah. Okay. Well, Hong Kong at that time, trading volumes exploded. And we were at Merrill Lynch and then Li Ping and Fong, we decided to go to a locally backed brokerage. They wanted to create, you know what, I think the equivalent later what would become CICC. But again, we didn't get there. But a locally backed brokerage was called CPower. And it had one of the largest local retail brokerage networks. And we helped take a lot of the Chinese state-owned enterprises called RedChip public in Hong Kong. So we kind of saw that. And that's when I got more into an operations role, right? We were looking at upgrading the trading. At the time, it was still very paper-driven. You had to call in. So we saw a lot of opportunities there. Volumes were going up. We were developing great relationships with companies like Shanghai Industrial, Tianjin Development. Basically, these municipal state-owned enterprises that had they were conglomerates with different assets, and we were listing them. And so it was from that that I really learned about how people sometimes get caught up in a craze, and then how things go up, bubbles get created, and then bubbles kind of get popped. And we saw that in 97. So that was one very valuable lesson to see that, because that's when then the Asian financial crisis happened.
That was a tough one. Yeah.
I guess, Jeremy, I'm so old right now. I mean, when people said, oh, what were you doing during the last financial crisis? And I'm like, well, which one are you talking about? Because everybody's going to 08, 09. And for me, the big one was 97.
Let's talk about that, actually, because one interesting thing is that so many folks who are guests, but friends, actually, they remember their families being impacted, right? Their fathers or mothers lost their job, they had a downsize and so forth. But I'm kind of curious, because you saw that with your own eyes in the banking and associated industries. But what was the experience like from your perspective?
Well, we went from extreme highs. Everybody thought, hey, I could become a millionaire in a day it's no different than crypto. And I think if you have that perspective, you just say, wow, every time, look, back then I heard this time's different, and it's never different. So we went from everybody was trading and everybody got caught up in margin financing. That's another lesson, is do not take on debt. Don't take on debt. And I had friends, they were over leveraged. There were a lot of people who had to jump out of buildings. I mean, it's really sad. But to see that, and then you see what happened, then you saw the pattern just repeat itself. And once crypto's over, it normalizes, there'll be something else. I guarantee you that. But if you go through that, from that, what I learned was every generation has to read the lessons of the past generation.
And what's the lesson there, that people eventually go into collective overhype mode?
Same thing, FOMO, right? Everybody was buying these companies. And then at the height, there was a company called Tom.com, Li Ka-shing. That's when we saw the beginning of the internet. It was a heady brew of China, the internet, all coming together. And I remember there was a company called China.com. So to see that, it's just been the cycle that will repeat. And when we discuss this, you'll see how the cycle played out again. So 97 happens. We had to do a management buyout because one of our biggest backers was an Indonesian company. And if you remember, the Indonesian rupiah just went from, at the time, I think it was about 2,000 rupiah to $1, and then it got depreciated to 14,000. I mean, fortunes were wiped out. So we ended up doing a management buyout. I was still in my late 20s. I was asked to join in. And again, that's the other thing. If you always live below your means. Because if you can save up cash, you never know when there's opportunities when you can deploy it. And so it comes back to my college days. I was always a frugal guy because I just didn't have the opportunity to spend. I had a little saved up. I was able to participate in that management buyout. Again, very small sum, but we ended up then buying out the institutional business, corporate investment banking, asset management. And then Leaping was able to find a buyer, and that was Dresdner Klein Warp Benz. And so I ended up there. So that was a very difficult period, 97, 98. And so it's no different than where we are now, but I think that's really shaped my view, because I've been through this a couple of times. Things are never as great as they seem to be, and they're never as bad as they seem to be.
And what's interesting is that after this experience, you would eventually go on to enter venture capital in China. So could you talk to me about that first entry into the asset class of venture capital?
Yeah, and that really started when I was at Dresdner Klein Warp Benson. You know, I never really understood what corporate culture really meant. As a younger person, you're like, who cares about corporate culture? I'm just going to go to whatever firm pays me the most money. And the first time I realized how important corporate culture was when I went to Dresdner Klein Warp Benson. And so Dresdner Klein Warp Benson was a strange combination. First of all, you had Dresdner, which was this big German commercial bank. They had acquired Klein Warp Benson, which they were like the merchant bank for the queen, like very blue chip. And then they acquired this entrepreneurial Hong Kong mainland Chinese brokerage called CPOW. So now when you take those three cultures together, that's when you're like, whoa, that's when I realized. And I remember the first day, and that's when I said, you know what? I don't think I'm going to last very long here. Every morning at an investment bank, you get in, and that morning that you kick off the Monday meeting. And we used to do that at Merrill Lynch, CPOW, and they have it 9 a.m. I remember. And I go in, I get there at 9 a.m. Everybody's already seated there. And the Dresner guys look at their watch and say, look, at our bank, 9 a.m. means 8:45. Ooh, and I was like, okay. And they're like, okay. I'm like, it's your first time. You know, don't let that. I'm like, oh, okay. I got that. And then we go around the room, like we're introducing the Sea Power team, that part of the team. And I look at them and they're like, oh, now, Tom, why don't you introduce yourself? And I was like, oh, yeah, my name is Tom. And I'm just so delighted I get a chance now to be working at Dresner, Kleinwort, Benson. And I remember the senior German guy looks at me and he's like, Tom, it's Dresner. And I was like, whoa, oh, Dresner, Kleinwort, Benson. I'm thinking to myself, I don't think I'm going to last here. But it turned out that guy was great. But it helped me also understand, coming from the U.S., we thought things were only done the Wall Street way. But then working with this big German bank and then understanding what they were doing, leveraging their balance sheet. I mean, the idea was to leverage their balance sheet with the deal-making ability of a Kleinwort, Benson, and add that in with what we were doing in China and Hong Kong. On paper, that seemed great. And I think we were executing that. But again, it's where I learned how you have to create diversity, being inclusive. And I think they did a great job of trying to include everybody in this larger mission because we had a lot of competition coming out of the Asian financial crisis.
Yeah. And you went on to deploy in venture capital, and that's across Asia primarily. But those early days, obviously, as an asset class, is very unclear. It was very fuzzy. Definitely not many books about it. So how did you decide to say, okay, this is an asset class that I want to keep going on?
Well, I think to answer that, you may just step back a bit. I'll fill the gap from Dresner to how I got into VC. And it was very simple. When I was at Dresner, that's when the internet, so that was kind of 97, 98. The internet was starting to gain a place in the public consciousness now of Hong Kong and China. Like it was starting to trickle. It had already been developing in the US, but it was starting to gain. I got very lucky. Well, it depends. That's why in my life, I've also realized things that don't turn out the right way, there can be a silver lining. So one thing when we were back then at Dresner is they went by seniority to give you the sectors and the clients that you're going to cover. And we all had very high quotas we had to hit. I was at that time, I think, one of the youngest directors. And so I didn't get to pick until like last. And so you can imagine everybody wanted like real estate. They wanted real estate, the industrials, Li Ka-shing, Hutchison. And those kind of got taken off the table right away. And so when it got to my turn, it was like, what was left? And it was telecom, media, and tech. And they were like, well, geez, we think none of these are going to create revenue. You know what, Tom, why don't you take all three?
TMT, yeah.
And I was like, okay, but can I get an increase in my title so at least I look good? And I'm thinking to myself, I'm not going to generate anything. But back then it was like, I think Hong Kong. So I was covering the mobile guys and there were like six mobile operators. This is when getting a 3G license was a big deal. Like People's Phone, Sunday, Orange. And so I'd go cover these guys. And the one thing I asked, and the firm was quite nice, was like, if I want to learn more about this, I need to go to Silicon Valley. And they said, fine, you got to be able to generate enough revenue. And I said, okay, let me go out. And that's when I started gaining exposure. So what turned out to be, what looked like it was a bad thing, ended up being a good thing because I got to cover TMT. And I saw what was going on. And I was like, whoa, this is big. This is when Bezos was first starting. And how I transitioned was, there's an interesting story. So after the Asian financial crisis, the Chinese government basically assembled these think tanks. And they went around the world studying. And of course, they studied what was going on. The U.S. was doing incredibly well. I think Clinton was president. We didn't have a budget deficit. The Cold War was over. We had the peace dividend. The internet's about coming. The U.S. was running a budget surplus. We got rid of 30-year treasury bonds. And so the Chinese government, I think, was studying. And they came to a couple of conclusions. One of them was the U.S. has this thing called Silicon Valley. The rest of is mired in this economic crisis. The U.S. doing extremely well. What's the secret sauce? One of the ingredients was they had this thing called Silicon Valley. And at the time, I remember one of the government guys saying to me, Silicon Valley is powered by the ICs. And I was like, that's very observant. Integrated circuits. And he said, no, it's powered by the Indians and Chinese. And I was like, yeah, but you're right. And he said, guess where else has a lot of Chinese people? I'm like, oh yeah, China. Of course. Why can't China create a Silicon Valley? And so that was one of the key takeaways. And so then again, they went to a lot of these underemployed investment bankers like me at the time. And they're like, hey, how do we create something? Give us your best ideas. And I remember competing against the guys at Goldman, Merrill Lynch, the ORFA. These are guys of my generation. We came up with plans. And one of the ideas was, hey, why don't you create a venture fund? We were doing it because we're like, oh, this is a great way. Maybe we can make some fees because there were no companies going public. And so everybody's coming up with proposals. And I remember the guys, One of them was like, hey, we got this proposal from Goldman Sachs, and they said we can raise a $200 million fund and do a JV with the hottest VC firm at the time, Kleiner Perkin.
Yeah.
And they asked me what I thought, and I said, you're going to go there? They're not even going to take your call. And they're like, oh, no. And so they tried it first. They went out there, couldn't get anything done. And then they came back to me. They said, how would you do it? I said, look, start small. You got to find a firm that kind of has an interest in China. When government guys come in, they'll send an airport pickup. It's not like what we do in the States, right? You're very independent. And they said, okay, well, why don't you come up with a proposal? And I did. And we found a U.S. partner. And then after we did that, they said, well, you got to go raise the fund. I said, sure. And that became the Beijing Technology Development Fund.
Wow.
It was one of the first US dollar funds. And the idea then was very simple. We called it C2C, which was copy to China. Jeremy, it's so funny now. It brings back some memories. I remember back then, like if I was hanging out in Silicon Valley for a week, I'd go back to China and I'd instantly be smarter than everybody. It's like I'd gone into the future and I came back. That doesn't happen anymore. Because of what we've been doing in the internet, we've flattened the world. But then back then, there was this real kind of arbitrage. And so that's how I got into VC. We raised this, at the time it was a $60 million fund, and we started investing. And one of the big hits that came out of that was a company called Commerce One. And we brought them to China. Unfortunately, the technology really didn't work. And it was during that time that I got to meet a lot of the first generation China entrepreneurs. So the good news is we invested into Commerce One. We did extremely well. But the bad news is because I was invested into Commerce One, we passed on Alibaba twice. There's always good and bad, right? That's what I'm saying for everybody out there. Things that look like it's adversity may turn out to be an opportunity. And opportunities turn out to be adversity. So you really never know. You just got to be patient.
Yeah. And how did those experiences lead you to founding Gobi Partners?
At the Beijing Technology Development Fund, I was there. Again, I knew a guy called Wykit Lau, who actually recruited me when I was at CPower. And I said, hey, let's do this. So again, Wykit and I always had a great relationship. We were there, set up the Beijing Technology Development Fund. And then the dot-com bubble hits. So the Asian financial crisis, 97, dot-com hits. I mean, it's like the Olympics every 4 years. Before we can even catch our breath, dot-com bubble hits. And everybody, all the US guys, the JV part, everybody's leaving. They were last in, first out. And I remember going, oh, well, so, and we were thinking there, I had a lot more hair, better looking. Well, maybe not better looking, but a lot more hair. It was just like, what are we going to do? And we sat down and we said, look, let's clear through the noise. What's the key thing that we should be focusing on? And the key question was, did we think China was going to continue to innovate? And I think everybody was missing that. Everybody was just like, oh, the dot-com bubble, the internet. And we were just like, look, the internet is just starting in China. And do we think it will continue to get bigger? And when we sat down and we thought about it, we said, yeah. And so we just said, hey, we should do this. We should set up Gobi Partners. And our thesis then, we didn't want to, you know, the copy to China, we thought we could still do it, but we saw a bigger opportunity, which was homegrown innovation from China. And I know, Jeremy, when I say that now, you're like, oh, that's so obvious. It wasn't so obvious 21 years ago. That was sort of a big bet. And I remember that government guy, Chinese people do great Silicon Valley. Why can't they do it in China? And we just said, well, look, let's help them. And we set up Gobi Partners. And that's how we started. And I remember we made the decision to do it the week before 9/11. And then, of course, 9/11 happens. The world changes. So my first reaction was, oh, my God, this is a horrible tragedy. I had a lot of friends in New York, checked on them. And then about 2 weeks later, I was like, oh, my God, I just resigned. And we decided, OK, well, we have to go do this then.
Yeah. Any behind the scenes stories of what it was like to found Gobi Partners?
Well, I'd like to say it was a bed of roses. But no, it was difficult. We had many doubters. I mean, when you look back now, it seems so obvious. But I think others like myself, I think we were at the forefront. We had to educate the market. And I think this holds true. I'm telling this because it's the same thing as true for Southeast Asia. So I'll tell you some of the questions I used to get. And Jeremy, I'm sure you're getting them now. Is back then, I used to get a couple of these questions was, oh, how are you going to get exits in China? Can you point to me companies that have exited? And I was thinking, well, the whole point is you're supposed to what? Aren't you supposed to be a smart long-term investor? The whole point is, yeah, there are no big exits. They're going to be exits. But then you realize that a lot of the LPs, their risk appetite is different. And I came to learn and understand why is they need to see the data and there was no data. And it's interesting because now, fast forward, we're getting those same questions now for Southeast Asia. Oh, tell me about the exits. And so the only thing I can say to that, Jeremy, is there's no right answer. If I could go back into time, what I would say to a lot of people who are asking those out of good faith, but is this, yeah, there's no data. You almost have to believe, but again, they're like, I'm not in the belief business. And I get that. And I guess the only way you can answer this is, look, talent hits a target that no one else can hit. Genius hits a target that no one else can see. So at the end of the day, look, we know the exits are coming, right, Jeremy? But we don't have the data for it. So you almost have to just kind of see it. So that was a question we used to get all the time. And I always kind of counsel the newer GPs, look, fundraising's always been difficult. The second question is, say you could convince them on China. Then the second question always was like, well, is China doing real innovation? We hear that now for Southeast Asia. It's from the China guys. Yeah, so it keeps coming, right? And just like, oh, well, tell me what Southeast Asia is doing is not real innovation. It reminds me what the Americans were saying about China 20 years ago. And now you hear the Chinese guys going, oh, that's great, but Southeast Asia isn't doing real innovation. Do you know how many times I get that question, Jeremy? Can you please define innovation, right? So those are some of the things. And quite frankly, I mean, there were numerous times when we thought we couldn't continue. And if you remember, we set up in 2002, right after the dot-com bubble. What happens a year later? We hit SARS.
Right, in Asia.
And a lot of people forget that. But again, having gone through SARS helped prepare us as a firm for COVID-19 because we remembered what worked, didn't work. And we were fortunate because, again, when COVID happened, we had the playbook for what we did during SARS. And we realized that it wasn't the end of the world. We would come out of this. And in fact, if you had continued investing during SARS, you did extremely well, just like if you continued investing during COVID-19. If I could just add one thing, I think that the big opportunity now is like when I think back to what we were doing, it was really about providing access to opportunity for Chinese entrepreneurs. So that mission for Gobi has grown. We saw the same thing happening in Southeast Asia. And I think Monk's Hill saw that same opportunity as well, which is, hey, some of the stereotypes or misperceptions that the West had about China, Northeast Asia sometimes has about Southeast Asia. And now what we're seeing is that bias sometimes from East Asia towards South Asia or Central Asia. It just, all these provide opportunities. So Gobi's mission and what we started off as is an extension, and we continue to do this. And just anytime there's underserved or underrepresented communities, that's where we want to serve. And one of the big opportunities we're seeing now is in Taqua Tech, which is focusing on empowering entrepreneurs who are focusing on innovation for Muslim consumers, businesses, and communities. So I just did want to add that in. And we think that's a big opportunity, especially here in Southeast Asia, given that Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country on the planet.
Could you share a little bit more about what Taqwa Tech is?
Yeah, well, Taqwa is the Arabic word for faith, piety, and purpose. And so what we see is a large opportunity, and I actually think it's a bigger opportunity than even China was 21 years ago, is when you just add up the total addressable markets, right, Jeremy, for the global Muslim market or the global Muslim economy, you're talking about 1.8 billion consumers. It's almost 2 billion people. And it's the fastest growing demographic on the planet. We've created this investment thesis, and we call it Taqwa Tech. And we think that's going to be a very sector to be investing into for the next 10 years.
I do have some companies to refer to you then.
Absolutely. Please show them. We'll work together on them.
Yeah. On that note, could you share a personal story about a time that you've been brave?
Oh boy. I think maybe not just me, but my whole family. It was probably 2015. So we'd been in Shanghai, both my kids born in Shanghai. My wife's from Shanghai. My dad's family, I was loving it. But then we saw the data, and the data we saw, our interpretation was it was going to be a big opportunity connecting Northeast Asia with Southeast Asia. And again, that seems obvious now, but back then everybody was doing East to West. Let's connect China with the US, US to China. And there were many firms that did a fantastic, you know, Sequoia, China, right? Neil, when you look at what GGV was doing, Lightspeed, all these guys, IDG, fantastic, building out great franchise. And we said that that's the great strategy. But what we saw was there was also an opportunity to connect Northeast Asia to Southeast Asia, China, Japan, Korea, with what was going on. Our rationale was quite simple. It was, we saw Northeast Asia was aging. Northeast Asia was generating surplus capital, and Northeast Asia was developing technologies, they were ahead, developing technology, technology leader. When you then look at what was going on in Southeast Asia, it was the exact opposite. Southeast Asia is young. The demographics are young. They're entering the spending phase. Middle class is growing. Southeast Asia needed capital. And Southeast Asia was at the early stage of the tech adoption. So we said, wow, it fits together like a jigsaw puzzle. And so we decided we would really try to grow out the Northeast Asia to Southeast Asia linkages. And we created a name for this strategy. We called it Crouching Panda, Hidden Tapir. And I don't know if many of you are listening. You guys know, you know what a tapir is, right?
Yeah, but this is like both also to, anyway, there's a movie, right?
Yeah. So it's a play on Crouching Dragon, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. We call it Crouching Panda, Hidden Tapir.
Tapir. And we thought,
that term would take the world by storm. Unfortunately, it hasn't caught on. But that was our definition of kind of our strategy for Northeast Asia to Southeast Asia. So where was I brave? I'll tell you. So we first started off, we opened up an office in Singapore. I think we were one of the first China-based VCs to Zhuhai. We set up in Singapore. We did well. And then we decided to double down. And that's when I moved my whole family to Kuala Lumpur. And I'll tell you why I was brave. Because we were actually seriously thinking of leaving. And the reason was quite simple. When we were about to leave, I kind of tried to convince my wife. This is what I told her. I said, honey, you remember always during Xinyan, we always vacationed in Malaysia. So I'm like, hey, imagine we could now work in a place we like to go vacation at. And so she was like, okay. And I said, hey, and think about it. In China at the time, the air quality, it was kind of the peak when the air quality was really bad. And I said, Malaysia's fantastic. The air quality is great. And I said, in China, we've always been concerned. Sometimes there's corruption. And I think Malaysia's great. There's no corruption. And you don't read about it. It's kind of very safe as well. And so she's okay. So we get there in 2015. So what do you think happened? 2015 is the worst haze Malaysia's ever had in 50 years. Because I don't know what was happening, something in Indonesia, the wind direction changed. I don't know if you remember that. Yeah. The worst haze they ever had. 2015 was also when 1MDB's hitting the headlines. And so my wife's like, wait, what are you talking about? And that year, and I was like, Malaysia's very safe. That was also the unfortunate year of the tragedy where three airplanes right from Malaysia went down. And then on top of that, it was just like, I remember I was like, I'm so stressed. Things weren't necessarily going well. And then on top of that, my wife is like, hey, Tom, I think there's something wrong with my eyes. And I'm like, well, what's wrong? She's like, the walls seem to be moving. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, look at the walls. I think there's something wrong with my eyes. The walls in the guest room, they look like they're moving. And I said, what are you talking about? So one day I go into the room and I'm looking at it from afar. I didn't turn on the lights. And I'm like, whoa, it does look like it's moving. I turn on the light. And that's when I realized the wall is covered with insects, like these little bugs. So the wall looks like it's moving. It's because there's like thousands of bugs on the wall. And so, of course, we get the fumigator in and we're like, what is this? And like, oh, maybe Malaysia's humid. We can't identify the source. And then with all the stress that's going on, I finally said, hey, honey, can we bring out my favorite buckwheat pillows from China? You know what buckwheat pillows are? I like the buckwheat because it gives a little bit more support. And again, we've been so busy moving that we hadn't taken it out. So there was that one box in the corner. I'm like, honey, it's time to break out the buckwheat pillows. We open the box, open the buckwheat pillows, and it is swarming with bugs. The bugs from the wall came from the buckwheat pillows because the buckwheat had these like insect eggs. And we were like, we had to get rid of the buckwheat pillows. The insects were gone. And my wife was like, I've had it. We've got to go. She just, nothing has gone right. And I thought to myself, I'm like, we were trying to keep in low tones because the kids were asleep. And it's very funny. Kids have this innate ability. When you kind of yell at them, they don't listen. But when you try to lower your voice, they always hear. I remember what my wife and I are talking in hushed tones are like, hey, maybe we should go. This is a sign, right? The bugs. It's like biblical, right? And also, I looked at it, I'm like, well, I see my daughter. She's standing there. And she's, oh, mommy, daddy, what are you guys talking about? I'm like, oh, nothing. Go to bed, honey. And she's like, I heard. She's like, we can't leave Malaysia. I'm like, why not? She's like, "This, it's a test. And I was like, whoa. She's like, I like it here. Yeah, it's a test. And so I look at my wife and I was just like, whoa. And so we stayed and things got better. And I've been in KL now for 8 years and we kind of kept building out. And again, I know when I first came here, a lot of my friends, peers in China were a little skeptical. They're like, hey, why would you go to KL? It's a 鸟不拉屎的地方. It's so far away. The birds don't even crap there. And I'm like, I just really feel like this connectivity is going to happen. And we'll see. I think it looks like it's going to happen. I think the ecosystem, you know, what Jeremy, you are doing, Monk's Hill, others like Nick Nash, your other guest, I think we're building something that's going to be very important, not only for Southeast Asia, but for the entire planet.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. I'd love to summarize the three big takeaways I got from this conversation. First of all, thank you so much for sharing about your early university days, but more importantly, I think the story of your family, the dreams of your parents about a better life for themselves and for family, and how you're a product of their dreams, but also their work ethic and what you took into that, into prestigious elite institution like Harvard, but how you felt different, but also how you decided to make certain decisions about your career accordingly based on what you felt was important. So thank you so much for sharing about that. Secondly, thank you so much for sharing about your career, especially I think really parallels the growth of Asia. So we talked about the Asia financial crisis, but also the optimism of Hong Kong before that. We talked about the growth of technology across China and Asia, and also how your career was very much not just seeing it, but also being part of it. And I thought that was a really interesting arc to see that personal eye on that story. Lastly, thank you so much for sharing the story about how you set out to co-found Gobi Partners and how you had that initial thesis about connectivity, not just across Asia and in China, but also with Southeast Asia. So there's an interesting dynamic around the strategies that you had. But also I really appreciated, like you said, that how you've seen the patterns across the decades, the questions that people have. And I love what you said about the fact that isn't data for the future, because the future hasn't come yet. So I thought it was really fascinating to hear about how you continue, honestly, be a pioneer in so many ways. So I thought it was very interesting for you to share these different stories. So thank you so much, Thomas, for sharing.
Hey.
On that note, thank you so much, Thomas, for coming on the show.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. We would also appreciate you leaving a rating or review. Head over to www.bravesea.com for member content, resources, and community. Stay well and stay brave.